thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. We're going to start our story this morning in the prophecy of Ezekiel and chapter 20, because, in fact, we're not going to have time to cover all the story of the journey of the house of Israel back to the promised land. In fact, we're going to, as it were, jump a section of the story because of lack of time today, and we're going to deal with the final stage of their wilderness journey as they are about to come into the promised land. But just before we do that, we just wanted to make a comment on Ezekiel chapter 20, which puts the story this way concerning the coming out then of the house of Israel. You'll notice first of all in Ezekiel 20 and verse 27 that contextually we're in the right context again. So Ezekiel 20 verse 27, "Therefore, son of man, speak unto the house of Israel and say unto them, thus saith the Lord God, yet in this your fathers have blasphemed against me." Again, in verse 31, "For when ye offer your gifts, when ye make your sons to pass through the fire, ye pollute yourselves with all your idols, even unto this day, and shall I be inquired of you, by you, O house of Israel?" So here we have a prophecy that is again addressed to the house of Israel. And in the context of this prophecy, the 33rd verse says, "As I live, saith the Lord Yahweh, surely with a mighty hand, and with a stretched out arm, and with fury poured out, will I rule over you. And I will bring you out from the people, and will gather you out of the countries wherein ye are scattered, with a mighty hand, and with a stretched out arm, and with fury poured out." So here is the story now of the inviting of the house of Israel that they might commence their journey back to the promised land. And we're told in the 35th verse that God says, "I will bring you into the wilderness of the people, and there will I plead with you face to face." Now, we're not told here where the wilderness of the people is. We're going to have a look at a passage in a moment which I believe will help us in that regard. But we might just see what happens while they're in this wilderness. Verse 36, "Like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so will I plead with you. I will cause you to pass under the rod, and I'll bring you into the bond of the covenant. I will purge out from among you the rebels and them that transgress against me, and I will bring them forth out of the country where they sojourn, but they shall not enter into the land of Israel. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh. As for you, O house of Israel, saith the Lord Yahweh, go ye, serve every one his idols, and hereafter also, if ye will not hearken unto me, but pollute ye my holy name no more with your gifts and with your idols, for in mine holy mountain, and in the mountain of the height of Israel, saith the Lord Yahweh, there shall all the house of Israel, all of them in the land, serve me." And there we have a reference to the two houses of Israel now joined back together in the land, when the house of Israel finally have all been brought back through the wilderness of the people and are rejoined to the house of Judah, and they become the enlarged house of Israel, all of them in the land serving God. But before they get to that stage, says this prophecy, they must come through the wilderness of the people, verse 35. And it's going to be the story of Moses all over again, isn't it? God's going to plead with them face to face, like as he pleaded with their fathers in the wilderness. They're going to be brought into covenant relationship with him, and the rebels are going to be purged out. Now you'll remember that in the story of Moses' exodus, that a whole generation lost their lives. Those that were rebellious were purged out before Israel got to the promised land. It will be exactly the same in the story of Elijah's exodus. And Brother Thomas suggests that, in fact, quite possibly, again, a whole generation will lose their lives in the journey back to the promised land. And it will be the next generation who actually enter into the land. Now, whether that be the case or not, it doesn't really matter. What we do know is that there will be a tremendous purging process, and those that refuse to conform to divine principles, verse 38, will not enter the land of Israel. So it really is going to be, as it were, a recreation of the story of the first Exodus under Moses as they came from the land of Egypt and through the wilderness into the promised land. Now the question is, verse 35, where is the wilderness of the people? Well, we're not told, but we're given a clue in Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17 puts it this way. Where is the wilderness of the people that the house of Israel walk through on their way back to the land of Israel? Revelation chapter 17, and reading from verse 3 and from verse 15. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-coloured beast, full of names of blasphemy. Verse 15. And he said unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, the woman, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. Now remember we saw yesterday that the house of Israel is invited in Revelation 18 and verse 4 to come out of the midst of her. So there's going to be an exodus, isn't there, out of that spirit of the woman. Who's the woman? Babylon the Great. The mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Well, says Revelation 17, in describing the harlot system, it says two things. It says the woman is in a wilderness, verse 3, and she has influence over peoples, verse 15. And Brother Thomas says that he believes that the wilderness of the peoples is in fact the influence of the papacy throughout the earth. And so spiritually repressive, of course, has the Roman Catholic system of things been, that it has caused absolute spiritual barrenness wherever that force exists in the earth. And wherever Roman Catholicism is present in power, there is spiritual barrenness or wilderness, and particularly so, of course, in the region of Europe, where the influence of Roman Catholicism is in fact at its most powerful. It is spiritually a barren wilderness. And we would have to say that even today. Think about the teeming millions of Europe. How many ecclesias are there? There's in effect virtually nobody. There's virtually nothing of the truth in the area of Europe, because there the woman reigns supreme, and it is truly a spiritual wilderness. Now I believe that Brother Thomas is correct. Because you see, you think about it, we're told that the Jews are going to come from all four corners of the earth, aren't they? They're all over the world now. They've got to come from everywhere. Now it doesn't seem to be sensible to think that they're all taken to a particular place and that they then wander through a particular place for 40. I believe they wander through the world for 40 years as they make their way back from whatever part of the earth they come from. And I believe that, excuse me, things will be changed, of course, with regard to the mode of travel. The house of Israel, when they're invited by Elijah to come back to the land, are not all going to jump on jets. I believe they will travel by foot. And I believe that we might just come back to Ezekiel chapter 20. What we're saying, therefore, is the wilderness of the people is a metaphorical term. It is a symbolic wilderness where the influence of the papacy is, wherever that is. Now, the influence of the papacy is worldwide. And the Jews are worldwide. The house of Israel is worldwide. And I believe that what that means, well, let's have a look at Ezekiel 20. If the term the wilderness of the people is a metaphorical term, then we do not need to look for a specific geographic location for that wilderness, do we? If it's metaphorical, then we don't need to find a specific geographical location for the wilderness of the people, because it is a state of things, not a place. Now I believe that that means this in Ezekiel 20, verse 34. Notice these two phrases. Verse 34, I will bring you out from the people. Verse 35, and I will bring you into the wilderness of the people. So in verse 34, they make the decision to leave the country where they're scattered. And the moment they make that decision to leave whatever country they're in and to make the journey back with Elijah to the land of Israel, the moment they make that decision, I believe, verse 35, that the house of Israel has immediately entered into the wilderness of the people. They may still be in their own country, but the moment they make the decision to commence that journey, they find they're in the wilderness of the people. Now you stop and think about it. Since the advent of the spirit of democracy in Europe, what notable feature has been seen in Germany again, and in France, and in other places of Europe? The rise of anti-Semitism. And it's not just in Europe. It's in South America. It's in other parts of the world as well. Now you stop and think about this. Here we have millions and millions and millions of Jewish people making a decision to pack up their belongings and to make a journey back to Israel. And we know that one of the doctrines that the papacy is going to preach at that time is that the man enthroned in Zion is not the wonder in the land, he's the Antichrist. He's to be opposed. Isn't that why the Roman Catholic system at the time of the end stands against the Lord? Because they believe him to be Antichrist. And the influence of the papacy is to stir up the nations of the world to oppose the power enthroned in Zion. And here, all of a sudden now, our Jewish people say, we support the man in Zion and we're about to begin our journey back to the land to be with him. How do you think they're going to be treated? And they're going to go through all the experiences that they've been through in time past. Pogroms, confiscation of land, loss of property, persecution. And the whole world will, I believe, become to the Jew the wilderness of the people. And for 40 years they'll fight their way through that wilderness. It's a state of things. It's not a specific geographic location, because they do come from all four corners of the earth. And wherever they are, the moment they make the decision to support the power in Zion and to make the journey back to the land to be with him and with their brethren, they find that they have entered into the wilderness of the people. And how great and terrible a wilderness it shall surely be to them. Now we come to the prophecy of Micah in chapter 7. Micah 7, verse 14. Now what I've tried to do here in 10 minutes is to in fact cover a whole session, because unfortunately you've missed out on one of the sessions of this series. Being such a short Bible school, we have 12 days at our Bible school, and so one of the sessions in this series is actually I will bring you into the bonds of the covenant, and it's the story of their journey through the wilderness of the people and how God brings them into covenant relationship. Unfortunately we're not going to hear that part of the story, so I've really just compressed that just to make a statement on the wilderness of the people itself. But Micah chapter 7 verse 14 says, feed thy people with thy rod, the flock of thine heritage, which dwells solitarily in the wood in the midst of Carmel. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old. According to the days of thy coming out of the land of Egypt will I show unto him, him being the house of Israel, marvellous things. The nations shall see and be confounded at all their might. They shall lay their hands upon their mouth, and their ears shall be deaf. They shall lick the dust like a serpent. They shall move out of their holes like worms of the earth. They shall be afraid of Yahweh our God, and shall fear because of thee. And so the house of Israel will be given strength to make that journey. And the house of Judah, or at least some of the house of Judah, the refined third, will be with them. And so will the saints, and so will Elijah. And we're told in several Bible passages that the house of Israel will literally have to fight their way back to the land. They'll fight their way back. They'll fight their way through country after country. You imagine if you're in a group of 10,000 Jews trying to travel to the land. And let's say, for example, you've come from South Africa. And you've got to make your way by foot through Africa, up country by country. Now, one of the fastest growing religions in Africa, in the African continent, Islam and Roman Catholicism, converting 2 million people a year in Africa. And when that spirit of the papacy is whipped up at the time of the end, people are going to oppose the Jews, and they'll fight their way back. And verse 15 says of Micah, according to the days of thy coming out of the land of Egypt will I show unto him marvellous things. And I believe that there is an appropriateness that the days of the second Exodus will in fact be the same 40-year time period. Now, by the way, I don't think you can definitively prove that from Micah, because I think the sense of Micah contextually is, according to the days of thy coming out of the land of Egypt, will I show, it'll be the same sort of thing. It'll be the same sort of experiences. I don't think it's specifically mentioning here or meaning here the specific time period of the Exodus, but I believe personally that there is a great appropriateness in that, because this is truly, in many senses, as we said before, a recreation of the story of the first Exodus all over again. And I believe that 40 years is in fact an appropriate time, and it locks in with the other time periods that lead up to the beginning of the kingdom age itself. Now, where we start our story, and we've now got to the start of our story for today, where we start our story now is at the end of that 40 years, when they're brought close now to the area of the land itself. And this is what Brother Thomas says in Mystery of the Covenant. He says, at the end of 40 years' sojourn in the people's wilderness, so that's obviously taken from Ezekiel 20, isn't it? Elijah conducts the tribes to the borders of the land. It would seem that the tribes march from the south toward the Red Sea, and from the west, north, and east to the Euphrates flood, from which two points they form a junction in the intermediate wilderness. Now, you'll see that I've underlined the two words for wilderness here, because Brother Thomas is talking about two different things. When he talks about the people's wilderness, he's talking, as we've said, about a metaphorical state of things. It is a symbolic wilderness, spiritually, representing, in fact, all the world through which the house of Israel have to fight as they journey back to the land of promise. But when they come to these places here, to the Red Sea and to the Euphrates flood, they meet together in a junction in what Brother Thomas styles the intermediate wilderness. And the moment he uses that term, and for the next few pages in Mystery of the Covenant, he's now talking again about a literal piece of land, the land between those two areas, the Red Sea and the Nile, because he's now gone back to geographical dimensions. He's now talking about the real area of wilderness between those two spots. So he says they are to be gathered from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and the regions of the Western Sea. These lie at all points of the compass with respect to Palestine. Having to congregate from such opposite directions, they will no doubt move towards the wilderness, and he's talking about this intermediate wilderness here, they will no doubt move towards this wilderness in armies, fighting their way through the countries, and coalescing as occasion may serve until they arrive at their destination. My reasons for concluding that they will approach the wilderness from the Red Sea and the flood of Euphrates are, first, because it is written, Yahweh shall make a gathering of his fruit from the flood of the river to the stream of Egypt. You'll see how there are two different geographical locations there, as I've underlined them. There is the Red Sea and the stream of Egypt, and there's the flood of the Euphrates, styled here the flood of the river, and Brother Thomas says the basis of his reasoning is Isaiah chapter 27. So let's have a look at Isaiah 27 now, and see how Brother Thomas actually drew the conclusion he did from this particular passage of Scripture. So what we've done now is we've jumped over 40 years of history. They were only just about to come out under the spirit of Elijah, weren't they, in our last study. We've now gone over that 40-year period, and what an interesting 40 years it is. But they are now coming close to the land itself, and we're now going to pick up the story as they draw close to the land of promise, and they come to what Brother Thomas styles the intermediate wilderness. Now, here in Isaiah 27, then, and verses 12 and 13, it says this. It says, And it shall come to pass in that day, saith Yahweh, it shall come to pass in that day, that Yahweh shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt, and ye shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel. Now, Brother Thomas translates the words beat off as what does he call it? He says it, he styles that a gathering of his fruit. Yahweh shall make a gathering of his fruit from the channel of the river. And we believe that that in fact is a sound translation based on a number of uses of that particular text. The word beat off that's used in Isaiah 27 verse 12 is found, for example, in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 20 and Ruth chapter 2 and verse 17 concerning the beating of fruit off the trees. So the trees are beaten in order that the fruit might be gathered. The word is actually shabat, which means to knock out or knock off, that is, to beat fruit off a tree or to thresh, as it's also translated in Judges 6 and verse 11. So Brother Thomas translates that, and I believe fairly and reasonably so, contextually, that it's to do with the gathering of his fruit from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt. So there's two different places there. The channel of the river is one place, the stream of Egypt is the other place. Now the channel of the river, he suggests, is the Euphrates. And the reason for that is as follows, that the word river here is the Hebrew word nahar, N-A-H-A-R. And whilst it's not used exclusively of the Euphrates, it's used very widely concerning the Euphrates. Actually, I'll show you an interesting example of that. If you come to Joshua chapter 24... So you see, Isaiah doesn't say what river, it just says from the channel of the river. Brother Thomas says that's the Euphrates. On what basis does he say that the river is the Euphrates? Because the Hebrew word nahar is very extensively, not quite exclusively, but almost so, used of the Euphrates. Here's an interesting use of that term. Verse 2 of Joshua 24. And Joshua said unto all the people, thus saith Yahweh Elohim of Israel, your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood in old time. Now that's a problem Bible quotation if you're talking about the flood, because people say, see, the flood was only a local thing in Mesopotamia. It wasn't of worldwide dimensions, because it says that your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood, so the flood can't have been very big. Ooh, that's a bit of a stumper, isn't it? But the word flood is actually the Hebrew word nahar, and it's the word generally translated river, as in the river Euphrates. And that's exactly where Abraham dwelt. Your fathers dwelt on the other side of the nahar in old time, even Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. And I took your father Abraham from the other side of the nahar. And the story of Abraham is the story of the crossing of the Euphrates, isn't it? So that's actually the Hebrew word here, nahar. So that's the answer, by the way, to that problem Bible passage. It's not the flood at all, it's the river. And that's the same word translated river here back in Isaiah 27. God will gather his fruit from the channel of the nahar on the one side unto the stream of Egypt on the other side. Coming back to Isaiah 27 verse 12. So what's the stream of Egypt? That's got to be the Nile. So we've got two rivers here. God's going to gather his fruit, and that's the fruit from the house of Israel. He's going to gather them on the one side from the channel of the nahar, that's the Euphrates, unto the stream of Egypt, that's the Nile. And between those two points, those two borders, the house of Israel are now going to be gathered. You'll notice, by the way, it says at the end of Isaiah 27 verse 12, and ye shall be gathered one by one. So you see, not all do respond to Elijah's invitation. And even if they do respond, not all of them make it back through the wilderness of the people. It becomes an individual response, and they're gathered on an individual basis, person by person, out of the house of Israel. Now, just to show that Brother Thomas is sound in his reasoning on suggesting that the channel of the river of verse 12 is actually the Euphrates, look at now the terms of the 13th verse. Verse 13 says, and it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were, now look at these two terms, which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, that's where the river Euphrates is, and the outcasts of the land of Egypt, that's where the river Nile is, and they shall worship Yahweh in the holy mount at Jerusalem. So Brother Thomas says, look, there's the two extremities here. And from those two border points, as it were, the house of Israel are now going to be gathered in the intermediate wilderness, the stretch of land that goes between those two borders, the stream of Egypt, right up to the channel of the Nahar, Assyria to the north, Egypt to the south. And so you could just about do a little something with colour on that, couldn't you? You could colour the word channel of the river in one colour in verse 12, and use that same colour to colour the word Assyria in verse 13 to lock those two together, and then use a colour to colour the phrase stream of Egypt, and then the word Egypt in verse 13 to lock those two together, so that you've reasoned contextually concerning what the two rivers are of the 12th verse here. Well, Brother Thomas goes on to say in Mystery of the Covenant, he puts it this way. He says, here are a gathering and a gleaning, so that no stragglers may be left behind. Now, between these two extremities, there is to be a highway from Assyria, beyond the Euphrates, styled the Nahar, into Egypt beyond the Red Sea, even to the Nile. And Yahweh shall dry them up the tongue of the sea of Egypt, and he shall shake to and fro his hand over the Nahar by the violence of his wind, and he shall cause to smite it in seven streams and make to pass through in shoes. From this and the former text, I understand that the flood of the Euphrates, that is below where the Tigris falls into it, will be made fordable, and the Gulf of Suez entirely destroyed, so as to facilitate the passage of Israel from Pathros, Cush, and Egypt into the wilderness to meet their brethren from beyond the flood. This accords with what follows, and there shall be an highway for the remnant of Yahweh's people who shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. Well, that's Isaiah chapter 11. So let's go and have a look at Isaiah chapter 11 now and see how this adds to the story now of the highway. I will make in the wilderness a way, which is of course the title of our study this morning. So in Isaiah chapter 11, we're told this in the 15th verse. It says, "And Yahweh shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea," semicolon, so that's one thing. And Brother Thomas says that the tongue of the Egyptian sea is the Red Sea. It's not the river Nile, it's the sea, the Gulf. It's the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and the Egyptian sea of course is the Red Sea. It's the tongue, that the part of the Red Sea that protrudes up into the area of Egypt there. So on the one side, Yahweh shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and on the other side, with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the Nahar, that's the Euphrates, isn't it, and shall smite it in the seven streams and make men to go over dry shod. Now you'll notice there's a slight difference here between Isaiah 27 and Isaiah 11. Isaiah 27 gave the two opposite points as being, what were the two points of Isaiah 27? Isaiah 27 was in fact the stream of Egypt and the river Euphrates, but here in Isaiah 11 it talks now about the destruction of the Red Sea, the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and the smiting of the river Euphrates. So we seem to have two slightly different stories here in these two chapters. There's really no difference at all, because Isaiah 27 is talking about the borders between which the intermediate wilderness will exist, and at which the two collection points for the house of Israel will be. So the two collection points for the house of Israel are the stream of Egypt on this side and the river of the Euphrates on this side. Those become the two collection points for the house of Israel. They either come from the north or they come from the south, and whichever part of the world they come from, they congregate at those two particular collection points. But Isaiah 11 is not talking about the two borders of the collection points. Isaiah 11 is talking about the two passages of water that they have to cross. And this group here have to cross the passage of the Euphrates.
Whereas this group here specifically come across the tongue of the Red Sea, which of course was the very route followed in the days of Moses. And it will be like Moses too, because you see what it says at the end of that verse. And he shall make men to go over dry shod. Now you see what the margin says. The margin says in shoes. What do you think that means? What's the implication of that? He shall make men to go over in shoes. Sorry? Yes, it's an antitype of what happened before, but there's something more than that. Think about it. If they're going to cross a river and they can do it in shoes, Roy? It must be dry. It's not squelchy mud. So complete is the miracle of the parting of the water here that they might pass through these two collection points that they're able to walk through in shoes. And the antitype is, as David suggests, and you may like to take a note of this, is Exodus 14 verse 29, but the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea. There's the antitype. Exodus 14 verse 29. The children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea. So here's the story of the first Exodus all over again. And so complete and so total is God's miraculous power to provide a passage for his people that it's bone dry when they walk through the channel of those waters. So total is the miracle that God provides for them. So there's a passage formed on the one side through the river Euphrates and on the other side through the tongue of the Red Sea as they make their way into this area here known as the intermediate wilderness, the gathering point now for the house of Israel, who've either come from the south or from the north, whichever part of the world they have come from. And that really takes us to Zechariah chapter 10. So in Zechariah 10 now, we have some further information upon this same story. You'll notice just how, as we go through these passages again, how closely they are locked together in the text. So Zechariah chapter 10 and reading from verse 8. Zechariah 10 says, verse 8, I will hiss for them. Actually, that's the Hebrew word used for the piping of a shepherd. So it doesn't mean he'll hiss like a snake. He'll hiss for them in the sense of whistling for them or piping for them. I will hiss for them and gather them, for I have redeemed them, and they shall increase as they have increased. Who is it contextually, by the way, that's being gathered here? Verse 7. Ephraim, that's the house of Israel, isn't it? The house. So we're contextually correct again, aren't we? This is about the gathering of the house of Israel. Verse 9, and I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries. But the revised version changes that slightly, and I think it gives a better sense of the text. The revised version reads, though I have sown them among the people, they shall remember me in far countries. And that's really the point of this, isn't it? Though I have sown them among the people, the day will come because of the work of Elijah when they shall remember me in far countries, as Elijah invites them now to come into the wilderness of the peoples and to make their way back to the land wherein Messiah is enthroned as a wonder amongst his people. And you notice the Elijah term at the end of this verse. What's the term that identifies that this is Elijah's work of proclamation? And they shall turn again. Remember we found that term about Elijah a couple of days ago? To turn the hearts of the fathers to the children. Here, this is Elijah's work. So here's the regathering of the house of Israel. Although they've been sown among the countries, they will remember me and they will turn again, because that's Elijah's work to do just that with the house of Israel. Verse 10, and I will bring them again also out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria. So here it is. I'll bring them out of the land of Egypt and I'll gather them out of Assyria. Now, in fact, they're not really coming from Egypt and Assyria at all, are they? They're actually coming from the four corners of the earth. They're coming from everywhere. They're coming from the whole world. But why does Zechariah 10 and verse 10 say, I'll bring them out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria? Because these are the two collection points whence all the house of Israel assembles. And so they are finally gathered from these two places, because that's where they've all come. They've actually come from all parts of the earth. Now let's read on. Verse 11. And he shall pass through the sea with affliction, and shall smite the waves in the sea, and all the deeps of the river shall dry up, and the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away. Now we've got some waters here again in the 11th verse. So what are the waters then of this particular verse? It says, first of all, he shall smite the waves in the sea. What's the sea? Sorry? No, it's the tongue of the Egyptian sea. Right? Keep to our context, remember. This is literal. We're talking about literal geographical terms here. He shall smite the waves of the sea of Zechariah 10 is the equivalent of what he does to the tongue of the Egyptian sea in Isaiah 11. So the waves of the sea, of the Egyptian sea, are smitten because the house of Israel is coming back and they're going to be gathered out of these two points. But he also says, and the deeps of the river shall dry up. What's that? That's the Nahar. That's the Euphrates on the other side. And then he says, the pride of Assyria shall be brought down and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away. So here we've got these two points and these two rivers again. You see, it's locked together quite strongly, isn't it? Now, I'll tell you what I've done. I've used a little bit of colour there again, and this is what I've done, just to make that stand out in the text. I've taken the word Egypt in verse 10, and I've coloured in the word Egypt in verse 10, the word sea in verse 11, and then the word Egypt again at the end of the verse, those three in the one colour. Egypt, the sea, and Egypt, because that's the one collection point, that's the southern collection point, and the sea there refers to the tongue of the Egyptian sea through which they will be passed once God has smitten the waves in the sea so that they might pass through. And then with another colour, I've coloured in the word Assyria, verse 10, river, verse 11, and Assyria again in another colour. And when you do that, all of a sudden that text just absolutely jumps out at you and makes good sense. These are the two collection points all over again. He smites the sea and they come from Egypt. He smites the river and they come from Assyria. They'll cross the Jordan here only when they get to that point. Yes, you're a wee bit ahead of me there, Auntie Annie. We're only here yet. But we will get there, I promise. I promise we'll get there, hopefully before this study finishes. But we've got a wee way to go yet. So it says there, you'll notice at the end of verse 11, and the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart. Then you think, well, I don't know what the scepter of Egypt is particularly today. Well, you see, these two places are being used in a certain sense, in a symbolic sense. You know, there's a prophecy in Amos where it says, publish ye these things in Assyria and tell it in Egypt. And you see, Assyria and Egypt represented the two great power blocks of the day, didn't they? I'll put that back on. This is really the territory of the king of the north, the northern power. There was always a northern power, wasn't there? And there's also always a southern power. These are the two great power blocks of the world. And I believe that they're being used in some metaphorical sense as well as geographical in Zechariah, that the two great power blocks of the world will be humbled at the time that the house of Israel is coming through. It says, by the way, there, just before I move off Zechariah, in verse 10, place shall not be found for them. You see that phrase there? Place shall not be found for them. Why does it say that? Well, because you see, what's happening here is the house of Judah are already in the land, and someone mentioned this the other day. The house of Judah are already in the land. Actually, you'll enjoy this map. This is a very special map, this one. I want you to see if you can find something unique in this map. So here's the house of Judah in the land, about 3 million. These statistics are pretty old, by the way. They're about 15 years old, and so the population numbers have grown a bit. But at that stage, about 15 years ago, there was 3 million in the land of Israel. And here's, that's the house of Judah. And here's the house of Israel. Another 3 million in the area of Russia, 100,000 in Asia, 75,000 in Australasia, about 500,000 in South America, 6 million in America, in North America, 1.3 million in Europe, and about 170,000 in South Africa, a total of 11 million. So the house of Israel is about three times the size of the house of Judah. So when the house of Israel are all brought back from those two collection points and brought into the land, no wonder it says place shall not be found for them. In fact, Isaiah 54 says, doesn't it, enlarge the place of thy tent, take the pegs down and peg it out a bit wider, because there's a whole lot more people now, because now we have all Israel back in the land, and there's a sense of the tremendous influx of numbers here that increases the whole house as it's back in the land. What's the unique feature of that map? New Zealand's on it. It's the only map I've used during the course of my sojourn here with New Zealand. Very important to notice that. Yes. Yes. I didn't use it in the lecture. I never had Israel on any of my maps in the lecture, because the lecture was all about how we will lose our feelings of nationalistic pride and support Jerusalem. So I very tactfully didn't put New Zealand on the map. Actually, I didn't have room for it. That was the real thing. Now, in Isaiah chapter 19, then, we have another passage that has a bearing on this particular matter of the highway and of the gathering of the people. Isaiah chapter 19, and just the last three verses. I'll keep this map on because it's actually quite helpful just to keep seeing this. And it does help to understand, I think, these particular texts. Highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrians shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptians into Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom Yahweh of armies shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel mine inheritance. So we notice several things about this text. First of all, we've got the same two areas again, haven't we? Egypt and Assyria. See how these texts are locked together. And there's a highway, it says. There shall be a highway out of Egypt that goes all the way to Assyria, says Isaiah 19, verse 23. So much so that you'll be able to travel on that highway later on. You'll be able to go from Egypt to Assyria, or from Assyria to Egypt. And I believe, by the way, that what that is telling us, and I'll come back to this later on, that although this highway in the first instance is for the house of Israel, it'll be used by others in the kingdom age. It will be used by the Gentiles in the kingdom age, and there'll be a means of transportation of the movement of people between those two particular places. Now you'll see that it says in verse 24, in that day shall Israel be a third with Egypt and with Assyria. And you think, well, that's a bit funny. Here we are about the prophecies of Israel's restoration, and now it says that really Israel's only a third, and that these two places, Assyria and Egypt, are just as important as Israel. Israel's only one third out of three thirds. No, I don't think that's what the text means. In fact, you see, I think that what it means is that Israel stands as the intermediary between the other two. Israel shall be the third with Egypt and Assyria. In other words, Israel is the third between the other two. Israel stands as an intermediary between the other two. Now remember, the other two represent effectively all the world. The two great power blocks of the world. You can either come from the north or the south. You can't come from anywhere else. The whole world will converge on those two centres. And Israel is the third in between them. Now notice contextually that that's correct, because that's Isaiah's own definition of what it means for Israel to be the third. You see what Isaiah says in verse 24? In that day shall Israel be the third, even a blessing in the midst of the land. You see that? Israel shall be a third, even a blessing in the midst of the land. So when it says that it'll be a third, it doesn't indicate that Assyria and Egypt will have equality with Israel. Rather, it indicates Israel's supremacy. Israel will be the third part. That is, says Isaiah, a blessing in the midst of the land, and the highway will sweep in from the north and in from the south to converge upon the third part, which is Israel. And Israel, of course, what does Israel mean, by the way? Prince with God, he who will rule with God. And so Israel, of course, is going to be the ruler of the age to come, ruling with God, not so Assyria and Egypt, because verse 23 says that Assyria and Egypt shall serve. Israel shall rule, Egypt and Assyria, verse 23, shall serve, after their power has been humbled, as Zechariah chapter 10 and verse 11 tells us. Now let's just summarise what we've got so far, because I think there's several interesting observations now that we can make about this particular highway. The first thing is this. Why Assyria and Egypt? Well, as we've said, because they are taken to represent the world in opposite directions from the land of Israel. So the two collection points become representative of everybody. You can only come from those two places, as it were. So the terms Assyria and Egypt are being used in a sense here in these passages to represent the whole world. And here's the second thing. The very geography of the land here will mean that when the house of Israel assemble at these two collection points to then come into the wilderness, that they might come into the promised land, the very geography of the land means that they must participate in an act of national baptism. They've either got to cross the Euphrates, or they've got to cross the tongue of the Egyptian sea. Either way, they will be nationally baptized through whichever collection point they come. Now come and have a look at Isaiah 51 and just see a reference with regard to that. A couple of quick references. So the very way in which the geography of the land is so ordered here means that the whole house of Israel now have to be baptized on their way back to the land, on their way back to Christ, on their way back to the house of Judah. Isaiah 51 verses 9 to 11. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of Yahweh. Awake as in the ancient days, in the generations of old. Art thou not it that hath cut Rahab and wounded the dragon? Art thou not it which hath dried the sea, the waters of the great deep, that hath made the depths of the sea a way for the ransom to pass over? Therefore the redeemed of Yahweh shall return and shall come with singing unto Zion. So they must pass through the depths of the sea, says Isaiah 51 verse 10, after the manner of the generations of old, verse 9. That's the story of the first Exodus, isn't it? Come and have a look at Psalm 68. Just one more reference on that. National baptism will be a prerequisite for the house of Israel as they return back to the Lord Jesus Christ. So Psalm 68 and verse 22 says, Yahweh said, I will bring again from Bashan, I will bring my people again from the depths of the sea, says Psalm 68 and verse 22. So they're all going to be baptized. Actually, interestingly enough, you know how there's a reference to this highway? There shall be a highway there. Do you know that the word highway in the Hebrew actually means a thoroughfare with a turnpike? Anybody know what a turnpike is? What's a turnpike? Yes? It's a freeway. What's a turnpike, though? Yes? Yes, we may even use the term turnstile, mightn't we? It actually really means, here, the sense of it is a toll gate. In other words, to get on this particular road, you've got to pay a toll. Now, where do they pay the toll? They either pay the toll here, or they pay the toll here in the form of being baptized into Christ. You must pay a price to get on this particular road. You can only travel on this highway if you've paid the toll charge. And the toll charge is that you must submit to the act of baptism by which the house of Israel becomes identified with the Lord Jesus Christ. And in doing that, do you know what they do? They memorialise one of two things. Depending on whether you come from Egypt or Assyria, you memorialise one of two things. Those that come from Egypt, what do you think they memorialise as they cross over the tongue of the Egyptian sea? They memorialise, that's right, the coming of Israel out of Egypt in the days of old. Those that pay the toll here and come across the river Euphrates, what do they memorialise? Crossing of Abraham into the promised land. So whichever side they come from, there's a principle of memorialisation. And here's another thing. You see, the boundaries of the collection points, the boundaries that are given, are not Egypt and Assyria. What were the boundaries specifically that were given? The two collection points, the borders in which the collection takes place, is the River Nile and the River Euphrates. The River Nile and the River Euphrates. That's interesting. Genesis chapter 15. That's the actual two collection points, isn't it? The Nile and the Euphrates. Genesis 15, verse 18. In the same day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abraham, saying, "Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt, the Nile, unto the great Nahar, the river Euphrates." So in fact, the two borders at which points this highway begins, and the two collection points for the whole house of Israel, are actually the dimensions of the land promised to Abraham. And you see, what that tells us is that the moment they pay the toll charge and they move onto that highway, I believe that they are in the land of promise. Their journey of probation is over. Although this might be described as a way in the wilderness, it is part of the land of promise. And the moment they assemble at those two collection points and begin that final state of journey along the highway that leads to Zion, they are in the land of the promises to Abraham. Their probation is over. This is now simply the final step that will bring them to Zion. Isn't that interesting? Now you see, I think this is important because there's a bit of a tendency to spiritualise these prophecies concerning the highway. And I think there is a spiritual application, by the way. There is a sense in which we have the way of the truth, the highway of the truth. But I believe that in the first instance, those references that we've looked at have a literal application. You think about it. You see, the nation of Israel literally is saved from her literal enemies and literally journeys back to the land, and they come eventually onto a literal highway. God has to make a provision for them in what was once the wilderness area, and we actually won't have time for it now, but the reading our chairman read said, can anyone remember what it did say in Isaiah 43? That I will make a way in the wilderness. I'll bring waters for my people. So that area will be actually physically transformed in order that the children of Israel can travel along that literal height. You see, there's no spiritual type without a natural first, is there? You can't have a spiritual highway unless there was a literal one for it to be the basis of a spiritual application. You see what I'm saying there? We build spiritual applications out of something substantial or literal in the first instance. So it does represent the way of the truth. But I believe that the primary application of these passages is to the physical highway, and it's going to be built for the house of Israel as they come back to the promised land. And we know one or two other details about the highway too. Let me just put one or two more things on, because we're given some scriptural detail about what that highway is like. So here we are. Some of the terms concerning the highway. So, what do we know about this highway? Well, we know that it's straight, Isaiah 40 verse 3. We know that it is actually grassed, Isaiah 35 verse 7. We know that it is holy, Isaiah 35 verse 8. We know that it will be protected, Isaiah 35 verse 9. We know that it will be watered, Isaiah 43 verse 19. We know that it will be elevated, and I mean literally elevated. I think it'll be a highway. You know, you'll see it lifted up off the ground, a nice flat highway running through, and it's perfectly even, Isaiah 62 verse 10. And I think there is both a literal and a figurative application of those prophecies concerning the highway. God's going to make, you see, this is the story, you see, of God making provision for his people. He wants the house of Israel back. And he makes provision for them so that they can return on the very highway that God's made for them in that area, and he's beautifully watered and elevated and protected that area so that as they journey back, it's a time of great happiness and of thanksgiving for them. Now come and have a look at Isaiah 35. Remember this passage in Isaiah 35? Here's one of these sort of what you might call fuzzy quotations where we think it's a lovely chapter, you know, and we sing in our hymn, "A rose shall bloom in a lonely place," and we think, I wonder what that's all really about. Well, Isaiah 35 is one of the prophecies concerning the highway. There will be a spiritual application to it, but it's based in the first instance on the literal. So you see what it says in the Isaiah 35 and verse 7. "And the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of dragons where each lay shall be grass with reeds and rushes." A green courtyard or a green highway. It's going to be grassed. "And an highway shall be there," verse 8, "and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those the wayfaring men, though fools shall not err therein." Now the last part of Isaiah 35 and verse 8 looks a little confusing in the authorized version. "But it shall be for those the wayfaring men, though fools shall not err therein." Rotherham translates the balance of that verse as follows. Rotherham says, "But he himself shall be one of them travelling the road, and the perverse shall not stray therein." You'll see how the margin supports that idea textually. The margin says, "He shall be with them." So Rotherham says, "He himself shall be one of them travelling the road." If you just hold your finger in Isaiah 35 and come to Isaiah 52, I believe that this is the sense of the text, reasoning from another passage, and again contextually from another passage on the same subject. So remember Isaiah 52 verse 11. This is the story, remember, of the house of Israel departing out and coming into the wilderness of the peoples. Depart ye, go ye out from thence, touch no unclean thing, go ye out of the midst of her, be clean. Verse 12, "For ye shall not go out with haste, nor go by flight, for Yahweh will go before you, and the God of Israel shall be your re-reward." Does anyone know what re-reward means at the end of verse 12? Yes, to guard at the rear, perhaps in the sense here that God goes before them, verse 12, and he also goes behind them. So they are surrounded by God. God goes with them. That's what Isaiah 35 and verse 8 says. "He himself shall be one of them travelling the road." But who is the Yahweh who goes with the house of Israel? It's not God himself. It's Elijah and the saints who are with Elijah. They represent Yahweh travelling with the house of Israel. Some of us will be there, brothers and sisters, on that highway. Isaiah 35 verse 8. "He himself shall be one of them travelling the road." And those saints who've been given the responsibility of going out with Elijah for the work of the restoration of the house of Israel will be travelling back with the house of Israel as they move now down this highway. So you see verse 10, "And the ransomed of Yahweh shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy." If you've ever wondered what that chapter's all about, it's about the return of the house of Israel, literally, on a literal highway, as they come back now into the land of the promises to Abraham, about to cross over the River Jordan, and to now be confronted with the meeting with their Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ. That's what that chapter's about. "And highway shall be there, and the ransomed of Yahweh shall return." Marvellous. It's a marvellous, marvellous story. So the whole picture of the story of this highway in the wilderness is the story of God's abiding love and care for his people. It signifies that their probation in the wilderness of the people has come to an end. Their purging is now complete. The rebels are all gone. Now the blessings of God can commence upon them. And the blessings start the moment they enter that highway. There's water. There's greenery, there's verdure, there's protection. The saints are with them travelling on the road. There's no perverse person on that road. It's a way of holiness. It's separated exclusively for the use of the house of Israel at that time. And this, that stupendous transformation that takes place in the wilderness is actually an echo of the tremendous change that has taken place in their whole hearts. Now that whole piece of land, the Arabian Peninsula, has ever been desolate and arid, hasn't it? It's always been a true desert. If anyone's ever travelled through that region, it truly is a desert. It's waiting for that day when God will cause it to blossom as the rose, so that a highway can be built there in order for the house of Israel to meet up. And as they do come along that highway, they will meet up. So there will be some coming from this side and some, and they'll meet up together here. And just imagine the laughter and the happiness and the joy that will be there as they share experiences about what it's been like to come through the wilderness of the peoples, and that now they're ready to be rejoined to their brethren in the land of promise. What a marvellous time of joy that will be for the house of Israel, because now they are truly home. And later, when the kingdom is established, the nations will, I believe, travel on that very highway as they come up to worship God. And you know what that tells us? It's a lovely thought, really, isn't it? That all the nations, if they desire salvation, are going to have to learn to walk in the way of Israel. That's the lesson, isn't it? All nations will have to learn to walk in the way of Israel. Jeremiah 23, just to bring our thoughts to a conclusion on this subject. Perhaps reading from verse 6, just to again show contextual congruency. Did you like that? In his days Judah shall be saved and Israel shall dwell safely. So here's the two houses of Israel. And this is the name wherewith he shall be called, Yahweh our righteousness. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that they shall no more say, Yahweh liveth, which brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but Yahweh liveth, which brought up and which led the seed of the house of Israel out of the north country and from all countries whither I had driven them, and they shall dwell in their own land. You see how careful the prophet Jeremiah is. When he refers to the first Exodus in verse 7, what does he call them? He calls them the children of Israel. That's quite correct, isn't it? But when he talks about the second Exodus under Elijah in verse 8, what does he call them? He calls them the house of Israel, because that's exactly who's coming up this time. It's not the children of Israel. The children of Israel is a term that denotes both houses added together. It was the children of Israel who came up under Moses. It's the house of Israel that come back under Elijah. See how carefully the terms have been distinguished here. Now, you know what the point of these two verses is? It really stops it. Do you know what this is saying? What this is saying is that up until this point of time, when Elijah goes forth, that the single greatest event, the single greatest experience that the nation of Israel has ever had in their entire history is the day they came out of the land of Egypt. See what it says, verse 7. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that they shall no more say, Yahweh liveth, which brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. As if there was no greater thing that you could ever say about the history of Israel than the day God brought them up out of Egypt. And you know what verse 8 is saying? Verse 8 is saying is, in the day when Elijah brings back the house of Israel through the wilderness of the peoples and onto the highway, that the story of the Exodus under Moses will finally be absolutely eclipsed. And the history book of the nation will be rewritten. And now they will say, Yahweh liveth, which brought up and which led the seed of the house of Israel out of the north country and from all countries whither I have driven them, and they shall dwell in their own land. And the second Exodus finally will become the story of the nation, eclipsing even that of Moses' time. And the yardstick by which they will measure the greatness of their God and of his influence upon them, that they might dwell in their own land. It's a remarkable story, isn't it? And notice again, how those references that we've looked at are so closely and carefully locked together contextually. Isaiah 27, Isaiah 11, Zechariah 10, Isaiah 19, Isaiah 35, it's all there, isn't it? That's Brother Thomas in Mystery of the Covenant. It's not me. All I've done is given you Mystery of the Covenant with a few little words of explanation. It's a marvellous story, brothers and sisters, and some of us will be there on that highway with the house of Israel in the day when Yahweh makes, in the wilderness, a way. Thank you.